Professor, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Well, church planters, I'm excited for today's interview. Obviously, you know me, Chesley. I got my friend Brian here. Brian and I were talking. He helped co-author the book When Helping Hurts. I think it's really a timely message for church planters. If you've listened to the podcast, I've been talking to some of our guests about what does mission strategy look like in church, and where do we, we get things wrong and we don't even know it. And so I think this book has been very helpful for me as a pastor, and I know it's going to be helpful for you as well. How are you doing, Brian?
Great. It's great to be with you today, Chesley.
Yeah. So, just give us your background. I heard you're in economics, and if in a different life, I think I probably would have been, economist at some point because I love the numbers. But how did you even get in this world?
Yeah, crazy story. So I'm actually a pastor's kid. I grew up in a church in rural Wisconsin, and a little village, 1,000 Dutch people, all related to each other. I'm 6'10". I'm pretty sure it's because
it's the cold weather. I don't know. Heat rises. You had to get that high to just feel warm.
So from a young age, I felt called to work amongst people who were poor and was just not sure what my gift set meant in that space. And it turns out I was really good at math. And so I discovered economics as a field that you could use a lot of math, but you could actually help people who are poor. And God's grace, was able to get a PhD in economics. I took a job after grad school at the University of Maryland. Loved it there, was really great, but the Lord was working on me, who He always is, of course. And real quickly, kind of three things happened. I was growing increasingly disenchanted with how economists think of what a human being is. Economists reduce human beings to purely material, rational creatures. And then I was an elder in my church, and I saw our church make the polar opposite mistake. We reduced poor people to spiritual creatures. And if they just repent of their sins, all would be well. They got out of poverty. And so I'm caught between these two things. And then I was asked to teach a Sunday school class. And I'd like to tell you that 40 days of prayer and fasting went into that. That's not what happened. I was in a Christian bookstore. I had to teach Sunday school the next day, grabbed a book off the shelf. And it was a book called The Glorious Body of Christ. It was a book about the theology or the doctrine of the local church. And so I fell in love with what the scripture says the local church is, you know, the body of Jesus Christ. It's where the kingdom is supposed to be bursting forth. And that kingdom addresses whole people, right? It addresses our bodies and our souls, right? And so I fell in love with the local church. And so one afternoon, I wrote a letter to the small college on top of a mountain in Georgia called Covenant College. And I sort of said to them, in a letter where I just said to you, and I said, somebody should start a center that would equip churches to be what the Bible's called the church to be, to minister to the poor as whole beings. And God blessed that work. And now we've got this thing called the Chalmers Center, which equips churches and ministries all over the world to work amongst people who are poor in more effective ways. And so I'm an economist, but I don't know what I am. I'm a multidisciplinary guy who loves the social sciences and loves the local church and loves theology.
That's cool. No, I love the through line that you're like, hey, I'm good with numbers. I love the local church, and I feel like I've got this mission to the poor. Like, so that guiding light.
That's it.
Who would have thought that, you know, economics would be the route, and then this whole center. You know, it's really, really cool, the story that had unfolded that allowed you to do that.
Thank you. Yeah. God has been guiding, you know, most of my life has just been one great big journey of learning. And most of what I write, including When Helping Hurts, it's kind of like a diary of things that I've been learning from people. And I'm good at synthesizing things and putting them out there. And so it's a lot of the stuff that When Helping Hurts is very antithetical to what I learned in economics, to be honest with you. And so it's a journey and sharing with others what I've been learning. Yeah.
That's really interesting. You know, what really started sparking me, you know, I was a church replanter in Omaha, Nebraska. I actually grew up being pretty poor as in American standards, one bedroom, rat infested trailer, ended up being homeless when I was 16. Yeah. And so I've always had a propensity to be inclined towards how do you get people out of poverty? You know, because if I'm worried about what I'm going to eat, it's really hard for me to worry whether or not Jesus is changing my life, you know, and taking care of my sins. So I empathize with that struggle. And again, I know American poverty is very different than everywhere else in the world, but growing up, you don't know what you don't know. You just know you're poor, you know, and, so I was just thinking about that. And as I grew older, I always had this tension, especially as a church replanter in Omaha. I actually did ministry in Section 8 housing in the most dangerous complex in Nebraska. And I didn't know how to help. I really just didn't know what to do. So a friend ended up giving me this book, which was you co-authored. And I was just pretty floored. You know, you got this whole industrial complex around non-governmental organizations because they tell you give to the organizations, you don't give to individual people. And I'm, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place. And as a church replanter, I'm like, what is going to make the most impact and what's going to be the most responsible? I just didn't have any clue. And I'm sure there are some of our listeners too are probably feeling the same way I do as they're on the ground trying to help fix the problem. What is the stuff that you really discovered as you walked into this, like this whole, I don't know, this whole environment?
Yeah. What a story. I should be interviewing you, Chesley. You're the expert on poverty, not me, you know, but I got to perform on this podcast. So here we go. So, you know, so much comes down to how we answer this question. What is poverty? Hmm. Because the way that we diagnose the problem determines the solutions that we use to alleviate the problem. And, you know, it's like when you go to the doctor. The first thing the doctor does is try to diagnose what's wrong with you. And there's two mistakes the doctor can make. One is misdiagnosing what's wrong and giving you the wrong treatment, and you're not going to get better. You might get worse. Or the doctor can treat the symptoms rather than the underlying causes. And you can feel better for a while, but you're actually just dying. So, you know, if you go to the doctor, say, I got a headache, and the doctor gives you, you know, some Tylenol, and your headache goes away, that feels better. But what if you got a brain tumor? Mm-hmm. You're just dead in the pain, the tumor can continue to grow. And so you can either misdiagnose the problem or treat symptoms rather than underlying causes. And the same is true when we work with people who are poor. And so if you ask most mainstream, you know, sort of middle class or upper middle class Americans, what is poverty? They'll say something like this. It's about a lack of food, a lack of clothing, a lack of housing, a lack of money. We tend to define poverty as some lack of material things. And then our solutions tend towards providing material resources to people. So this is what we do when we stop at a traffic light and there's a homeless person standing there. We roll down the window, put a quarter in that person's hand. It's saying to ourselves, they're lacking material resources. Let's give them some money, some material resources, and Shazam is going to happen. But we know that that's not what's going to happen. There's something else going on, right? And so what's interesting is if you ask poor people around the world, what is poverty? They'll answer it like this. And this comes, by the way, from tons of research. The World Bank once interviewed 60,000 poor families around the world, and they asked them the same question, what is poverty? The answers that people gave were things like this. I feel shame. I feel less than human. I feel like garbage that everybody wants to get rid of. I feel like I'm not heard, like I'm not seen. The poor tend to define their poverty in far more psychological, social, and even spiritual terms. We tend to define their poverty in material terms. And that disconnect is at the heart of the problem because we're approaching it as a material issue when it's actually the case that the material the material, the lack of material things is typically a symptom of something deeper. And that something deeper, I believe, is rooted in broken relationships. And so it's really about our whole book, our whole approach is about approaching poverty as primarily a relational thing, and the lack of stuff as a symptom of that deeper relational problem. We've got to get to the deeper relational thing.
Yeah, no, that's very, very helpful. You you brought me back to my childhood. I was just sitting there going like, yep, I understand that. And looking at like a lack of access because of it, you know? So I'm like, you're talking about symptoms. Like people would give us groceries, but it never fixed the real problem.
That's it.
My mom was not diagnosed with mental health disorders and didn't get the proper care until she was 47, you know? And I'm like, had she gotten it when we were younger, between my mom and my dad, like our lives would have been so much different, you know? So yeah. And we continue to do that in the church world where we keep dealing with symptoms. And I love how you bring it back to the relational piece. And I think where this, the focal point of relationships that happens, especially in church mission strategies, is the orphan. Like we're told to care for the widow and orphan in their distress. And so for us, we spend probably millions, I would dare say billions of dollars of American mission money going to orphans and orphanages, trying to help the orphan in their distress. And what I read in the process of the book and like taking like some of the other courses and stuff, resources that you guys had over the years, is like, actually, we're perpetuating damage we have no clue we're perpetuating. And so would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, this all comes down to what is a human being? That's really the whole thing. What is a human being? And again, Western civilization tends to define the human being as a material creature. And the church in the West has often kind of said, well, we have souls too. And we kind of view the human being, well, I got a can here of Coke. So we kind of view the human being.
I got a cup of Coke, so this works great.
we kind of view the human being as a body that contains a soul.
Yeah.
In the way that this can contains Coca-Cola, right? Mm-hmm. And so the body and the soul touch each other, but they're not really integrated. And you can sort of pour the soul out, so to speak, right? Well, that's not what the Bible teaches. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the Bible, the human being, the body and the soul are highly integrated, and we're deeply wired for relationship. God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is inherently a relational being from all eternity. The triune God exists in deep community. And we are hardwired in his image. We're hardwired for relationships with God, with ourselves, with others, and with creation. So we're not just bodies, and we're not just bodies that contain souls. We're highly integrated body, soul, relational things. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, hang with me. This is going somewhere.
Yeah. No, this is good.
Body, soul, relational thingies thrive in certain kinds of habitats. And when this body, soul, relational creature is small, the habitat which works well for it, the greenhouse, if you will, is a nurturing family. If you take this child and put this body, soul, relational thingy into an institutional setting like an orphanage, it's not wired for it's like putting an alligator in Alaska. It's the wrong habitat. It can't thrive and flourish there. And so institutions, it turns out, are bad habitats for relational creatures. I mean, just think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Institutions, the word connotes hierarchy, bureaucracy, rules. That's not how body, soul, relational creatures function and flourish, particularly when we're small. And so there's a ton of research out there saying, even when the orphanage is doing its best, even when it's not corrupt, we'll talk about the corrupt thing in a minute, even when it's doing its best, generally speaking, institutions are not as good as families for raising this body, soul, relational thing called a kid. And so there's a huge movement saying, how can we stop institutionalizing vulnerable children and keep them in families that are thriving economically and relationally?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that we need to rethink the way we do missions if we're going to help solve the real problem.
Totally. Totally. You know, it's estimated that American Christians, not counting churches or foundations, just individual American Christians, spend $2.5 billion annually on supporting orphanages all over the world. Mm. And that doesn't count the amount of money spent on the short-term missions trip to go for a week and hug the orphan that you're supporting through your dollars. And so the amount of money that we are pouring into this is off the charts. And the thing is, it comes from good intentions, right? It's not that everybody nobody's getting out of bed in the morning saying, gee, I want to hurt an orphan. But we're using an approach that can actually do way more harm than good. And Chesley, one of the first concepts in when helping hurts is focus on local assets. Try to identify the assets that already exist in economically disadvantaged communities or economically disadvantaged individuals. Don't approach it like there's nothing good there. Approach it like there's something good there that we can build mm-hmm. on. Well, in this case, what's already there are families. It's estimated that 80% of the children in orphanages around the world have at least one living biological parent. They're not orphans in the sense of not having any parents. What's going on is they have at least one parent, often two, who are economically disadvantaged. And out of desperation, they send their kid to an institution that promises food and shelter and clothing. And so the real solution here isn't to keep building institutions. The real solution is to strengthen the economic foundation of those families so that they can keep their kids in the kind of environment in which human beings can flourish.
So how do we do that?
So the first step is just awareness that so many of our strategies are doing more harm than good. And I've only told you the good part so far. Yeah, I haven't gotten to the bad part yet. So the good part is the orphanage is legitimate. It's trying to do good things. Yeah. It's not corrupt. And it's simply the case that institutions aren't as good at child rearing as families. That's the good story. Here's the bad story. The bad story is I'm a poor family living in rural Zambia, and I am having a hard time feeding my youngest child. And an orphanage recruiter comes to my village and says, we'll take your child and we will feed her. We will give her clothing. We will give her an education. And they essentially recruit children to be orphans. Now, the orphanage itself may be corrupt. Not always. I want to be careful here. That's not always the case. But the orphanage itself, this could just be a money-making venture. So that when the Americans come through, you've got all these poor, destitute kids that need support. And so it's a way of actually getting money. It's a form of human trafficking is what it is. It's a way of getting money from foreigners to fund your livelihood, and you might even make the kids look a little hungrier that day when the Americans come through. Maybe you don't feed them. You do something to make them look particularly vulnerable. The Americans come through and throw money at it, and you're essentially paying for a human trafficking industry. That's the worst kind of scenario. All right. Now, what's the solution? The solution is strengthen families. There are strategies that one can use to economically empower very poor families. One approach that the Chalmers Center that I'm a part of has been involved in is something called microfinance. It's a way of providing capital to very poor families so that they can start small businesses, to improve themselves economically, or to pay for school fees, or to pay for medical expenses. Whatever you have, any kind of financial shock to your family, microfinance can help you deal with that. Small business training, other kinds of initiatives. There's many organizations out there right now that are trying to figure out, can we stop institutionalizing, strengthen the families, and put kids back into those families?
Yeah, I love that. And so what you're saying is there's another way, and that way is through, is it strictly capitalistic means, by helping them like build these small businesses? Or are there other ways of doing that as well?
Well, I we want to don't take me down the path of capitalism, not capitalism.
No. I'm sorry. I didn't. Here's my thought process on it. Is like I have built small businesses in the U.S. Yeah. And some of them have worked, and some of them have not. And the ones that have not have been a lot harder, you know, yep, on trying to get out of a hole in the process. So that's the last thing I want for, and I know the amount of risk it takes. So when you got a micro financing, like there's still interest involved, there's still, so those are the things that I'm asking.
Oh,
not
great.
So much like, hey, what's the moral? I'm not putting a moralist approach to capitalism. I do know that done well, it is very helpful.
Perfect. So you're raising a really good point, is that you know when microfinance and microenterprise development came out, it was sort of the silver bullet, so to speak, about 30 years ago. The image was, you know, you just get people a little loan and it gets them the upward escalator out of poverty. Well, that just isn't true for a whole lot of people. Most people who are very poor are—they're not entrepreneurs because they're like Bill Gates incarnate. It's they're entrepreneurs by force.
Right?
There simply aren't jobs.
We're door dashing because we got to. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So that should temper our expectations about how successful this is all going to be. There are different approaches to microfinance. So I tend to favor something called a savings-led approach, because if you can help very poor people to save some money, it makes them less at risk of money lenders and interest rates than if they're borrowing. And believe it or not, very poor people can save. And so there's different ways to structure it to reduce the risk. With very poor people, what you're probably trying to do is to stabilize the family. It's not so much that they're going to become the next Bill Gates. It's more like, well, you've heard it said that you know, very poor people live on $1.90 per day. Well, the truth is they live on $3 one day and 25 cents the next day. The fluctuation in income is outrageous.
Yeah.
And so part of what you can do is just stabilize life. And that means that everybody's eating and the kids are in school and life is at least, it's poor, but it's stable. That's what you're probably shooting for.
Yeah.
And I should also mention there are wraparound services, Chester. You know, if you're working with very poor people, there are other kinds of services that you can provide, nutritional services, healthcare services, small business training. There's things you can do to sort of wrap around services, they're called, to help very poor families to get a little bit less vulnerable before they try to launch their own business.
That's really, really helpful. I am very empathetic to the struggle of trying to start your own business. So understanding it in that regard. So you're taking the training beside them, going, how do we first get you to ground zero? And build stair step from there. Businesses may be in your future. So
yeah, but the businesses we're talking about, this isn't like, I don't know, I launched a new record label. This is, like, you know,
eggs,
what?
Right? Yes. So like get a couple chickens and now you're selling eggs at the market.
That's it.
Yeah.
Very simple businesses, but it's enough to make your family stable.
Mm-hmm. So when you're able to do that, it keeps the kids from being able to need to go somewhere else, because the parents aren't giving them up because they just want to give them up. They're giving them up going, I'll get them food, I'll get them clothes. The most loving thing I can do is to give them away.
Yeah.
And so you're saying, no. Actually, the most loving thing you can do is let's help you build stabilization so that you don't have to keep them there. Yeah. So what would a church's strategy look like to do that in the U.S. to make sure that, hey, the dollars that we spend, we're doing it in a way that makes this work?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. You know, there are a number of organizations out there that work in the space of microfinance. So one example would be Hope International, a great organization. Tier Fund, another organization, World Relief. There are organizations that are working on stabilizing families. But then there's some that are very particularly focused on orphans and vulnerable children who are trying to figure out new ways of doing things. So the one that comes to my mind is an organization called Alliance for Children Everywhere. And they have a history of providing institutional care, but now they're trying to figure out, can they shift their strategy? Can they change it to more of a family empowerment approach? And so they're experimenting with some really great results. There's a kind of a whole movement of organizations that are experimenting and trying things out in this space. One of the things I should mention is, think about the challenges. Think about, let's imagine that I'm a Christian organization and I've been running an orphanage for 50 years. And all of a sudden, now I read this research that says, oh my word, even on our best days, there's a better strategy. But now I've got a crisis on my hands, because I've got all these U.S. churches that are supporting this thing that I've been telling them for 50 years is the greatest thing ever. Yeah. And so even if I want to switch my strategy, how am I going to do that with my American supporters who are going to be like, dude, we've been coming there forever on short-term trips.
Yeah.
And so one of the things the U.S. church can do is be vulnerable themselves, ironically, is to say to your partners on the ground, you know, we've heard there's some better strategies. We're not going to bail on you. Can we be part of a better story here? Can we help pay for the transition? Can we help get your staff retrained? Because strengthening the family is a different kind of activity than feeding kids in your orphanage. And so staff have to be retrained. And so basically, the U.S. church needs to take a posture of, we're all in this together. How can we change and grow together? And we're with you.
Yeah.
We're with you. We're going to help you through this process of change.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a particular orphanage that we worked with down in Mexico, and they had a really nice facility. We sent them a lot of money, lots of kids. And then, you know, it wasn't very long after I went there that I started hearing about the research. And I'm an idea generator. So I'm sitting there going like, is it possible you could end up turning those things into apartments and then building a planned community? And so you're still doing food, you're still helping them, but now they've got this level, and then you've got classes during the day. Now people are pitching in. I don't know. I'm just thinking, like, there's something good of indigenous tribes. They all worked together before we became industrialized. Could we not do something like that?
Dude, you're so good. So we were talking earlier about assets, and I said to you, most of these children, about 80% of the children in orphanages have at least one living parent. But it's way beyond that. There are extended families, and there's a stronger sense of community in a village in Africa than we would have in America. And so there's a sense in which the communities are strengths that we can build on. And you can actually do very creative hybrid models. So instead of saying, you know what, we're just going to ship all the kids back home and try to strengthen the families, what you can do is kind of a hub spoke approach. I've seen this in operation, where the orphanage changes from being an orphanage to being the provider of various kinds of services that the children and the parents can come to: educational services, nutritional services, how to be a good parent kinds of training, vocational training. You can sort of have a center that's providing those services, and then the kids go home with mom and dad to the village at the end of the day. That kind of approach.
Yeah, so like a community development corporation here in the U.S. Yeah, that's absolutely. So have there been unique stories of different approaches that you've seen have been worked very well? Yeah. Maybe there's a church planter that is listening to this. They're like, oh, man, we want to try that. Maybe there's a church leader that's a pastor that's not even listening or not planting, but they're listening and they're going like, hey, this is I really would like to try this. Are there stories that you're like, I can point to this one? This is really a phenomenal approach.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier Alliance for Children Everywhere. I think they've got a great model. And I, right here next to my computer is a story I printed out just before we got on the air. And it's a classic story of a mother, or two parents, who are struggling financially. They gave up one of their children to an orphanage. Alliance for Children Everywhere worked to strengthen the family economically using microfinance and some other wraparound services. The family was strengthened and the little girl was able to go back with her parents and be reunited with her family. So it is happening.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
It is happening. There's models out there and there's training resources out there. Christian Alliance for Orphans has a growing number of resources. It's a national network. With an annual conference, they have a growing number of resources, training resources, downloadable resources. They have a research center that's working on these issues. How can we do it better?
Yeah. So I'm really intrigued by marketplace ministry and this approach for helping. There's an economic piece to the missional side that I don't think many churches have tapped into. And I've got a friend in Belle Fountain, Ohio. About 10 years ago, he was young. He was in his 20s. Wanted, like, the town was dying, and there was a lot of poverty there. It's about 35 miles outside of Columbus, Ohio. And there's a bunch of old buildings, and he had a passion for restoring the buildings, but he knew that to do it well, he'd have to get businesses in there. So he actually took took some young people that were struggling but had some gifts and moving and building businesses in it. So now 15 years later, this whole town is bustling at the seams. It's the best place to live in Columbus, and it's not even in Columbus. Best food in Columbus, not even in Columbus. But now he's actually talking about they've done so much good in the community. They have a different challenge now, which is, how do we help people that are running our businesses, that are the chef and stuff, afford homes? So I'm sitting here going like, we have this one problem we fixed. There's this other problem that ends up shooting up in the process. Have you seen stuff like that? And like, obviously it keeps us in a job, I guess, job security. But it seems like there's always this yin and this yang of one cause, another effect. What do we need to be looking out for as we go through and do this sort of thing so that we can keep serving? And obviously there's going to be new issues that arise. Like, I'd love to get your riff and thought on that.
Yeah. So, wow. A couple thoughts. The first is, the fall of humanity into sin has had comprehensive impacts. And so people are not poor because of one issue. In most cases, it's multifaceted issues that are intertwined and complex. And so the idea that there's just this one silver bullet that we can, use and shoot at the problem and Shazam is going to happen, it's not the nature of the fall. The fall is comprehensive in scope. You know, there's this ridiculous debate. I'm sorry. Well, I just can't help myself. There's this ridiculous debate right now in the U.S. church. It's been around for years, and it's resurfacing right now.
Yeah.
Are people poor because of structural injustice or individual sin? go and ask kids in kindergarten in your church, what did the fall affect? And they're going to go, everything.
Everything?
And then yes. When they grow up, you train them to be Republicans or Democrats, they lose the storyline. It's everything.
Yeah.
And in addition to institutions being broken and individuals being broken, the Bible teaches that after the fall, demonic forces are given greater latitude. And yeah. So there's demonic things going on. So it's just, everybody should just chill out. It's big, it's bad, it's ugly. And the good news is the good news, the gospel. And the gospel is the good news, the kingdom of God. Luke chapter 4, verse 43, Jesus comes to usher in a kingdom which will bring healing as far as the curse is found, overcoming demonic forces, overcoming individual brokenness, and fixing broken social structures. That's the gospel.
Yeah, now, it's so good.
What does that mean? Well, it means that we as God's people need to be part of his story. Our posture ought to be, how do we participate in God's restoration of all things? Well, central to the biblical story is work. Adam and Eve are given a job to do in the garden. They're told to be fruitful and multiply, increase in numbers, subdue the earth. It's out of work that we experience our calling. It's not just a way of earning money. It's our calling. It's what we're made to be. Oh, and in addition, it does generate money that we can support ourselves and so on. It's like the first thing in the Bible. Go work.
Yeah.
The percentage of money that U.S. churches spend on promoting work for poor people is trivial. It's like the thing. And what we do are soup kitchens and clothes closets and all this kind of business. And there's a place for those things. I just offended half your audience. There's a place for those things.
No, this is phenomenal. I nobody has sat here and told us, you know what, maybe the better option is to help people discover their purpose through work rather than let's fix
the whole thing.
Their meal. I know it's like teach a man a fish, you feed him for a lifetime deal, but like the reality is that's not what's taught to us. That's not what's advertised to us in the U.S. church at all. It's give us your money, we'll take care of it for you and your partners in the mission.
But it whatever mission we're part of has got to be about creating work. And so, you know, the story you told earlier is a great story. And you know, I should have mentioned that in the majority world of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, there's a whole movement of Christians that are trying to start business. Christian business people are starting businesses that are bigger than these little micro things, mm-hmm. and they're hiring people into them. That's what it ought to be about.
Yeah.
There's called the Christian Economic Forum, which is kind of a whole gathering of Christian business people who are trying to do this kind of thing. And, you know, they were making money in, I don't know, Orlando, and now they're trying to figure out how to start a business in Ghana. And you know, they got up every morning, and instead of thinking about, you know, how do I make a bunch of money, they're asking, how can I keep 1,000 families in my company in Ghana employed? Praise God for that. Yeah. There's other initiatives in the U.S. There's something called Jobs for Life. The Chalmers Center I'm part of has something called Work Life. It's all about helping people to get work that's sustainable, that's meaningful, that's a way of glorifying God and supporting your families. It's the thing. And the U.S. church spends almost nothing on it.
And this, I don't know, I'm always looking for what's the application piece. I think this is it. Like... spending money on work as mission, like there's a whole movement of us talking business as mission. I'm hearing a lot of that coming from you, Brian. Like, talk to me a little bit about that as we start winding down the conversation. Yeah.
So business as mission is, you know, and there's different genres of that, but you know, some people use business as mission in which the business is sort of, it's not really a business. It's an excuse to get a visa to get into a closed access country. And you know, we can talk about that. But what I like are Christian business people saying, you know what? I'm really good at making money. And I'm going to go and I'm going to figure out how to make money in Kenya or in Uganda or wherever. But I'm going to do it with a sense of mission and purpose to provide employment for people, provide safe and secure jobs. What an incredible ministry. There's a whole global movement going on about this. Mm-hmm. And so we have no excuse. as the U.S. church, there are really good things you can do. So the message of when helping hurts is not, I'm sorry, I'm getting a soapbox.
Love this. I'm enjoying it, Brian. This is fun.
So, you know, the message of when helping hurts is not stop giving away money. The message of when helping hurts is whatever you're giving, quadruple it, but give it to things that are truly empowering to people.
Right.
And there are things you can do. Microfinance is one. Businesses, missions is another. There are empowering strategies you can use both at home and abroad to actually start to address the root issues.
So if there's a church leader that says, hey, I need to figure this out, would Chalmers be able to help them? Like, is there like avenues for them to go, hey, come over here. We're going to help you figure out what that looks like for your church.
Yeah, so great. Thanks for asking that question. So the Chalmers Center has a website. It's just it's spelled C-H-A-L-M-E-R-S, Chalmers. And there's a website there with all kinds of resources. We don't do a lot of consulting. We're more of a training organization.
Yeah.
One of the things that some of your listeners might be interested in is we have a new training process that we call Innovate. And it's basically any church or ministry can take this. And it takes you through a creative process of asking questions about what's already happening in my community? What are the assets that are already there? What are the problems that are there? How can we diagnose the root causes of those problems? How can we creatively imagine how to use the resources that we have in our community to anticipate the new creation that burst forth from a tomb 2,000 years ago and that's yet coming? How can we make that new creation a little bit more visible in our village, in our neighborhood, in our city? And so it's a process. It's not like a canned sort of, here, adopt this ministry. It's more like, we'll help you create your own approach to addressing the needs in your community.
Yeah, I love that. That's so good. So if somebody said, hey, Brian, I want to get more information. Is just go to Chalmers or is that? Yeah. Okay.
Go to Chalmers website. There's a bunch of stuff there and different kinds of trainings and resources we have. And that's one way to get going. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a very big feeling that you and I could talk for a very long time.
This is so fun.
Brian, thank you very much for the time. Like, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I hope we can have more of these. I really feel like the economic piece is the piece that the church has been missing. I really do. We don't know what we don't know. It's not a sin of commission, I think, in a lot of ways. It's that sin of omission, if you will. So, So this has been very, very helpful and enlightening. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, brother. Just a joy to be with you. And I'm excited about what you folks are doing. And we need thriving, healthy churches all over the world. And so it's a joy to be a part of this. Yeah.
Thank you, Brian.